podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Australia are ODI world champions once again, making it three consecutive world titles for Meg Lanning's side, with Alyssa Healy hitting a record 170 in that final. With me today to discuss that run-packed final, give a bumper preview of the County Championship, and discuss the IPL and the rest of the week's international cricket are Phil Walker, Joe Harmon and Taha Hashim. We'll also be joined by Mark Butcher later in the show, while Yaz Rana, on holiday this week, has done an interview with Rory Burns. But first, to Christchurch. It panned out pretty much as we expected, with Australia marching through unbeaten to their seventh Women's World Cup title. They are quite good, aren't they, Joe?
They are very, very good indeed, yeah. It's not great for the game that they are so much better than everyone else, but that's not their fault. You've just got to give them enormous credit. They've just got every base covered. Even the side just gets better and better. Now they've suddenly got a leggy who turns it big. So, you know, when you put that many runs on the board and you can throw it to a leggy who's actually getting proper turn, just they basically, yeah, got all bases covered. And it felt like in the lead up to the game, I thought England would need to have an absolutely outstanding individual contribution to have a chance. And they had that and still lost by 70 runs. And it just went to show the kind of the gulf in class between the two sides. And I'm sure we'll come on to England's frailties over the course of the tournament because there were plenty of them. But first and foremost, just congratulations to a brilliant team. Nasser Hussain said at the end of that game, we're probably watching the best women's cricket team that we've ever seen. And I think that's absolutely right. I don't think there's anyone that kind of runs them close, even previous Australian sides.
So. You said that it's not great for the game. You mean not great for the tournament? Because it is great for the game, isn't it? That they are showing that this is the level that can be reached.
Fair point. It depends how you look at it. But if you want tight finals, if you want games where they're actually going to be competitive, then I don't think it's great for the game that we sat around here, we talked about the tournament and we basically all said, yeah, Australia are going to win it. If that continues just for the next decade, in lots of ways, I don't think that is great for the game. In terms of the talent and the skill on show, obviously that is fantastic. And I do think Australia will drag everyone else up with them. And that's what you hope to see from England in the next few years.
For now, it's like something to quite kind of marvel at. But if it gets to a point where, I mean, like a footballing equivalent would be like the German league, you know, like Bayern Munich winning the league every year. That's not particularly enjoyable, right? I think we're still at the stage where it's like, I think, especially because they didn't win the last World Cup. This is what they've been building towards for 5 years. And now this is kind of the crowning achievement. And so it's still, there's something still kind of novel to how incredible they are. And I think the thing that's quite enjoyable right now is kind of the different ways you can look at how great they are. You could look at their winning streak in this format, but you can also kind of look at the scorecard where you have Meg Lanning coming in at 5 and making 10, and she could claim to be the greatest ODI batter the women's game has ever seen. You could look at Perry coming in at 7, not bowling, and like they could get away with not using the greatest all-rounder they produced. That's like the thing is you kind of assume with a great side that the great players are leading it, but it's, you know, everyone else who's kind of stepping up and just everywhere they kind of have the player. And Eccleston, who's the bowler of the tournament, performs against everyone else, and then against Australia, a combined figures of 1 for 148 or something like that.
Anand had a difficult Ashes series against him, and they really go after her, and other teams aren't really capable of doing that because she barely bowls a bad ball, but it's worked for them.
But this is what happens when you give the format the respect it deserves, and when you back it financially, and when you embed it properly into your cricketing culture, and when you treat it on a relatively even footing. And Australia have done that for years now. And so it's the culmination. Well, it's a series of culminative moments, I suppose, but it's absolutely consistent with where they've placed women's cricket over far longer than any other country have. And England have been the only other country that have probably paid lip service to taking it seriously, but it's only really in recent years, last 2 or 3 years really, where it's actually properly been backed financially. the hope, of course, is that with broadly equivalent resources, the England side and the England setup can narrow that gap. But they're playing catch up, as of course are the whole of the world.
Yeah, I guess it's because it's not just as if this is a golden generation of a side, as you say.
No, it's a golden era. It's a golden culture.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's a triumph of one cricketing setup over another. I mean, another player you could pick out was Alyssa Healy. It was the star of the final and the semi-final, first player at any World Cup to make hundreds in both of those, and had a pretty middling tournament up until then. But they can it's kind of always someone that they have so many players able to deliver those kind of match defining performances. Hannah Needham asks, how can the rest of the world compete with Australia? And Joe, do you think is that gap getting wider? Should we expect to see something similar in 2025, or will the changes that England put in place, do you think that will narrow the gap by then?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's a time lag, isn't there? So I think at the moment the gulf is probably getting bigger, or is kind of perhaps reached its peak. But that's because a lot of the positive changes that have been made, particularly in English cricket, haven't really come to fruition yet. So the extra professionalisation of players, the women's 100, that is all going to have a big impact. The women's BBL, I can't remember the year it was formed, but it's going on for several years, and you're seeing the impact of that, young players coming through. You're also seeing it in selection, in that Australia are far more willing to give young players a chance because they've seen them do it in the WBBL, whereas I think this England squad was a bit conservative in its selection, and that was in part because they haven't really seen a lot of those young players get a chance to show what they can do on a bigger stage. And I think that will change quite quickly. And it all, in terms of, we're talking very kind of an English centric view, and it's harder to talk about other women's cricket in other countries, because to be honest, India, obviously, if they decided, well, we're going to put our energies into this, well, then that could change very quickly indeed. And they could rival Australia in 4 or 5 years, be right up there to this standard. But there is not, it seems, the desire to make that happen. Ganguly has not been the force of positive change that some hoped that he might be. But in England, I'm quietly confident that I don't think this is going to go on for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I think the gap will close, but maybe not immediately.
Yeah, I would echo that, and maybe take it even a bit further down the chain to the grassroots level, where you're hearing not just nicely packaged sound bites from, you know, paid governors and so on, but real lived-in experiences from volunteer coaches at grassroots level, and from kind of cricket board employees as well, who will talk to you on and off the record about the work that's being done in the margins of English cricket. And the numbers of girls who are now being exposed to the game as a percentage is considerable and incomparable to what it used to be. The number of girls-only cricket teams has gone through the roof in recent years. The number of girls who are exposed to the game at an introductory level through the various schemes that are in place, and various cricket boards are in cahoots with Chance to Shine and other equivalent kind of charities that the MCC Foundation and so on are doing good work. All of that helps break down those barriers that have been around the game for very long. If you look at the social demographic of the England team, as Sheil Berry was acknowledging, that it's still quite narrow, and the professional pool and the semi-professional pool is still relatively narrow. But I do not think, if we're being positive about the game's future, I don't think that will be reflected. I don't think it will be sort of skewed in 5 to 10 years' time. I think that there is good things happening now out there in a way that simply wasn't for female cricketing participation in previous years.
Yeah, I suppose it'd be interesting to see in terms of selection in the immediate future, in terms of how England get the results better, you know, for the T20 World Cup next year, for example, how quickly they decide to bring those players through, because this was the Commonwealth Games this summer, which is a massive opportunity. And you might say that this current crop have a better chance of winning that than if they brought through, say, the Alice Capseys and the other players, but also maybe that now is just the time to back all that youth. I don't know.
There's an interesting situation developing with Brunt and Trubsell. I mean, it's not quite Broad Anderson levels, and hopefully it doesn't get to that level of kind of animosity. But Brunt had a poor World Cup, a really poor World Cup, which I didn't really see coming, because I thought she bowled brilliantly in the Ashes, particularly in that Test match. But I think she had maybe 7 games where she didn't take a wicket, which is just so unlike her. And Trubsell, I thought, came back into the tournament quite well. But it's all a case of how the two beneath that are probably getting people most. Well, there's Freya Davis is already part of the group, but then there's Lauren Bell and Izzy Wong, who are both being talked about for a little while. They're still both young. It's when you make that change, and we're seeing this with the England men's test team, it's a really hard call to make. And I just wonder whether Brunt and Shrubsall might make that call for themselves quite quickly. When Isha Guha interviewed Catherine Brunt for the magazine, perhaps last summer? Brunt talked about the fact she's got a kind of a property business going, and she now feels like there is something beyond cricket which she didn't have before. So, you know, I think she'll probably stick around for the Commonwealth Games, and then that might be it. But they are going to have to start thinking about that transition.
Yeah, and Shrubsall is not old by any stretch, but she was notably emotional around the final as well. Like, she was one of the more visibly sort of affected by the anthem. And in the aftermath as well, obviously it's hard when you are the final wicket to fall. That might be more natural. But Nasser Sain, even on commentary, was just stopped short of saying he expected her to basically call time in the very near future to say we will see what happens with those. Let's talk about a couple of other players, I guess. I mean, one of the England players, along with Eccleston, who did emerge and improve reputation, was Nat Siver, who made two unbeaten hundreds against Australia, which is a ridiculous thing to do across a World Cup campaign. And that innings in the final was just one of the all-time great innings in a losing cause, wasn't it?
Phil said ahead of the tournament, I wrote prior to that, that this was going to be a kind of a real moment in Siver's career, because she's obviously achieved a lot, but there is that sense that she has actually underachieved on a personal level just because of how good she is. And what she produced in that tournament, kind of, she answered those critics, but also kind of backed them up as well, in a sense that, you know, she scored two brilliant hundreds against the best team we've ever seen in the game. But then that does make you think, well, we should have seen more. I think she scored five ODI hundreds in her career now. She should have double that.
And four of them have come in World Cups as well. So it's...
And this is it. And you kind of... She's such a tricky cricketer to analyse, because part her weaknesses are kind of also her strengths, and that you can watch her sometimes and think, kind of, give a bit more. There's not a kind of obvious passion there, and you think maybe that's why in games that don't matter so much she doesn't perform. But then also in a really high pressure situation like the final on Sunday, it was massively to her benefit that she had that attitude, and she was really, you could see, smiling all the way through it, talking to some of the younger players that came out to bat with her, and she stayed calm, perhaps because the target was so big it took some pressure off. But she was so calm and was managing that situation so well in really demanding circumstances. So you kind of can't have it both ways. We can't kind of criticise her for being too relaxed, when actually that is absolutely to her benefit at times. But I think hopefully she's still 20. She's only 29. She could still have 4 or 5 years of being a really top level England player. So hopefully this is kind of a corner turn where she's scoring, rather than just lovely 30s, 40s, half centuries, the odd hundred. Now we can hopefully see a run like Perry has produced kind of in the 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, reasons to be cheerful. Sophia Dunkley played a couple of key innings as well in her first big 50-over tournament. She's a fascinating player to watch. You know, she's creative and she's watchable, and there is a model there that hopefully other girls can look to emulate. You know, her pathway into a side which has not always felt especially open to young players, and that is possibly a question mark against Heather's approach, that she trusts players possibly to a fault in the end. It's both a good thing and a bad thing in a captain, I suppose.
You could argue that has stunted Dunkley's progress a little bit as well.
Yeah.
I think they've been a bit slow to get her in, to be honest. Given her talent, is that obvious?
Yeah, and she has a bit of kind of big match spark to her as well, as we saw in the bilateral between England and Australia. So, you know, there are reasons to be cheerful. You mentioned Lauren Bell. It'd be good to see her come through. You know, she's tall. She's got a bit of pace. She's got a really good record. Be interesting to see when she makes her call. So, yeah, look, it's been quite chastening, you know, and fair play to Australia for really setting the bar impossibly high on something in some respects. But yeah, they have to start now, really. This is the wake-up call, in a way, really.
Spin bowling as well, in terms of, they had, well, obviously they have Eccleston, but Charlie Dean came in, bowled really well, but then they have depth there as well. I mean, Sarah Glenn wasn't even at the tournament. She's done pretty well in her first couple of years of international cricket. They've got Maddie Villiers as well, so I mean, that is one thing. In terms of, yeah, I mean, we already talked about the quicks. That's going to be the kind of point of the attack where they're going to have to slowly kind of phase out and kind of actually identify two solid replacements there.
Yeah, I suppose the other big area where England would perhaps let down was the fielding. I think both Haynes and Healy were dropped and they're on about 40 in the same Kate crossover, sort of tough chances, but ones that if they'd taken them, then maybe they win that game. And I guess that is one of the other big things separating them and Australia, and probably one of the big things that come with professionalisation and just being able to do it week in, week out. That's something you just have to hone rather than rely on natural ability to sort of make up the gap, if that makes sense.
I mean, that was frustrating because those two catches felt to White and Siver, you'd expect they're two of their better fielders, two to the safer pairs of hands. You can talk about kind of golfing class or whatever else, but that those were two catches that those two players should have taken, really. And, you know, then it could have been a different game. Even it was frustrating watching that chase because even though they were going quite well, you felt like even they'd just been able to keep them to 320, that could have been a really, really good game. Because it was the constant need to keep up with the rate that led to them losing regular wickets, which meant the game wasn't quite as close as it should have been. I think 320 would have been a decent game.
Overall, though, you know, it's a brilliant tournament in terms of the advancement of the game. Some brilliant individual games, some real tight games as well. More last over games probably per game number than any big tournament that I've seen.
I actually looked into this and you're spot on. Just in terms of either last over finishes or wins by 15 runs or fewer, this is just way, way out ahead of any other tournament in history. I suppose that if you could say that makes the best ODI World Cup ever. I guess you could argue maybe it was an incredible seven-team tournament and then Australia kind of did their own thing, possibly. But yeah, an incredible tournament. And, you know, Australia were pushed in a couple of games. I mean, there was always the sort of thing they were holding teams at arm's length a bit. But England got close-ish in that first group game. They were a couple of slightly more substantial partnerships have really pushed them close in the final. South Africa took them to the last over as well. Yeah. So, like, even with their dominance, there was still... And Elise Perry said this after the game that, you know, they still felt they were under pressure at various points in time. So, yeah, an incredible tournament in terms of how close everything was. On to the County Championship, and I spoke to Mark Butcher about the scheduling of the competition and also about England's search for a managing director. Hi, Butch. Slightly less picturesque settings than last week, but I suppose you had to come home at some point.
There's nothing wrong with my extension. Nothing beats Grenada, though, for great views. What a beautiful place that is.
Yeah, I suppose it must have been a bit of a rude awakening. Not sure when you came back, but it was snowing last Friday, which of course means that the start of the County Championship must have been less than a week away. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of who's going to win it and pick up players to watch, whatever. But start with the schedule itself. So the season starts with seven consecutive rounds of the County Championship. Obviously, it starts in early April. Stuart Broad is sitting out of the first round, basically saying in his column in the Daily Mail that he just wouldn't be able to play seven consecutive games in 7 weeks and then be fit for if he's picked for a full test summer. It seems to me that this structure still isn't quite right, I think.
No, I mean, it's horrendous. It's horrendous in lots of ways, really. What have we got? Sort of four rounds in April and then another three in May. They're almost consecutive, aren't they? You kind of... 7th, 14th, 21st, 28th, 5th.
It's literally Thursday to Sunday every week, I think, yeah.
Yeah, they are, you know, which no team is going to be able to play sort of the same 11, you would imagine, each time with only, what, three and a half days in between the matches. Pitches are going to be an issue, obviously. You know, it's been snowing all week. So they're not going to be conducive to lots of different types of cricket, whether that be, you know, run making can actually sometimes be easier when it's freezing cold because the ball doesn't do anything. You know, the bowlers find it very difficult to find any sort of movement. But the pitches will be slow, and you know, all of the usual problems that you're going to have with playing first class cricket at this time of year. And also that, I mean, Stuart's absolutely right. If your plan is to be involved in the test matches as they begin, you know, the back end of May, beginning of June, then the last thing you want to be doing is playing seven consecutive championship matches in the run-up, you've got to try and hedge your bets a little bit as to where, you know, as to where you need to get yourself in order to be able to then take time off to be ready to go and play those test matches. So it causes an enormous amount of problems. Notwithstanding the fact that it's not very pleasant playing when it's freezing cold. You know, it's not a game designed for it, a ball designed for it, or fielding is not designed for standing still for long periods of time in temperatures of less than 10 degrees. So very, very tricky. And dare I say it, wrong. So that's something that whoever the new managing director, whenever he or dare I say she, is given the job, is going to have to look into, because it can't go on. I mean, I'm trying to think back to my, you know, the final years of my time in first class cricket, and if you played two matches in April, you considered yourself a little bit unlucky if you got both rounds that were in April, let alone playing four of them. So, you know, it's, nobody likes it, least of all the players. Groundsmen don't like it. And it really doesn't help. It doesn't help, you know, if you're talking bigger picture in terms of producing top quality test match cricketers, whether they be pace bowlers, spinners, or even batters. None of that is of any use to any of them, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things with Broad is that he also said in his column that whether he gets picked for England isn't really down to how many wickets he takes for Notts, which is true for him, but isn't true for lots of other players. Like if you are an Ollie Robinson wanting to prove your fitness, or a Craig Overton wanting to take stacks of wickets, or, you know, many other seam bowlers, you are going to want to play every week to make your case as unanswerable as possible. But then that also means that if you're a guy who might bowl, you're going to have to bowl within yourself, right? You can't play seven consecutive games at 100% as a fast bowler.
No, although that's a real throwback to the days before players were contracted. That was kind of how you got yourself into the test match team in the first place, was that you'd play as many championship games, take as many championship wickets as you possibly could, and then be 70% fit when you got the call up to play in your first test match of the summer. That's how things used to be. Central contracts have removed that. So, you know, in many ways, I suppose the difficulty for the guys on the outside is not actually a difficulty. Stuart Broad is a contracted player. Jimmy Anderson's a contracted player. Ollie Robinson's a contracted player. All of these guys will be at the top of the list when it comes to selection, regardless of what happens in the initial part. The key for the bowlers, as always, and the selectors with the bowlers, is being able to pick them when they are fresh, fit and firing, bowling well, etc. So for them, seven matches perhaps, for the ones that are contracted anyway, seven matches in the beginning isn't really an issue for them, because they would never be expected to play them anyway. For the guys trying to break in, different story. And of course, for the batters, where the issues have been starkly to the fore once again, due to the way that test match series in the West Indies finished up, you have the lottery of kind of, you know, what sort of batting conditions are you going to be faced with in those seven matches leading up to the first test match, and you know who is going to win the lottery and play on the decks that are slightly more friendly, and who is going to find themselves with it zagging all over the place and not being able to lay a bat on it for half of their lead up matches to the interim. And therein lies the issue, because if bowlers are getting sort of unnatural or uneven assistance due to conditions or pitches, it's difficult to then judge them on merit, and it's also very difficult to judge batters on merit, depending on, you know, what conditions that they've managed to come up against and what bowlers they've managed to come up against in order to get themselves selected in the first place. So you're leaving whoever has the honour or dishonour of having to pick the side in the first place, going on things like feel, and going on things like what you're hearing from coaches and from what other judges are talking about, and actually almost having to disregard the numbers as being an indicator of whether or not somebody deserves to be picked. And if you have a system whereby disregarding the numbers is actually a good thing or a sensible thing to do, then your system isn't doing the job. It's killing people, a system like that. But that's where we are. And that's where we have been for the last, goodness knows, for far too long, at least for the last two or three seasons, for one reason or another. But going back further than that also, as the season has been pushed more and more to the margins in Championship cricket.
Yeah, you mentioned pitches there. Obviously, you mentioned a lot of stuff there, but we've got a chat with Rory Burns coming up later on the show, and he talked a bit about pitches as well and about groundsmen in particular. And I know you got a little bit of stick from a couple of county groundsmen about, part of the course, it's part of the one of the risks of the trade, isn't it? But Burns was making the point that, we do have lots of good groundsmen, they work really hard, but the demands just of having to, create pitches in March and then also having to create pitches in September, even October sometimes, it is just inevitable that you are going to have to either underprepare some or have some which are, and that is just, that's also one of the things, it's almost not about when you're playing the games, though it is that it's the fact that there is just so many that you can, once you're trying to fit this much in, the pitches are inevitably going to suffer no matter how you structure or move it around or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And, anybody with a non-emotional reaction to what I said, which was, the pitches have been terrible, but that's another story. The other story is that the time being asked to prepare them when there is no heat, you're going to struggle to get solid, hard, rock-hard surfaces when you start playing your championship matches in April. The other challenge is having to produce so many pitches for so many different types of different formats of the game, one after the other, meaning that your ground is never fallow, if you like. You never have the chance to sort of get out there on the surfaces and roll them to death and do all the other things that need to be done in order to prepare them in time. And therefore, you're kind of, all of your preparation time is having to be scrambled and squeezed into these tiny periods wherein, the weather might not be helping you out. You might have to keep the damn things undercover for a week because it pees down the rain, all of which is completely and utterly valid in terms of defence of the groundsman. And I haven't for a second had a go at a single, I wouldn't even dream of having a go at a single groundsman for not working hard enough, not for preparing pitches properly, not for doing everything that they could in their power with their expertise to make things right. But the system we have doesn't allow them to do the job to the best of their ability. So quite rightly, they get upset and take it out on me. But, the outcome is what we talk about. If you're asking me to judge a pitch or if you're asking me to judge a player, I'm not going to judge a player based around the amount of time that he spent in the nets. I'm going to judge a player based around the amount of productivity and output he has as a run scorer, a run maker. And similarly, if you talk to me about pitches, I'm not going to excuse the pitches for not playing particularly well because I know the groundsman worked really hard. That's now how it works. What are you interested in? You're interested in the outcome. You're interested in the type of cricket that is able to be played and the type of cricketers that are able to thrive and survive on whatever the surfaces you have. And at the moment, the surfaces, for all of those multitudes of reasons, aren't producing the desired outcome. And it's the outcome that's the issue, not the blokes who are sat on the lawnmowers. Hopefully they haven't resigned or whatever it was that they were threatening to do.
Is it simplistic to say that 14 first-class games, 14 county championship games is just too many, basically?
Well, it's only too many if your sandwich is if there is too much of everything else. I played, it wasn't so long ago, it was 16. Now 14 is too many. Why is it too many? Well, because we've now got four competitions instead of just three. And in those four competitions, the 50 over one has all but disappeared. So, that it can't be right. I've spoken about how, and this is, something for whoever your director of cricket ends up being is, if the 100 is here to stay, which it is, right? I don't think there's any question about that. The counties themselves have kind of ensured that that's going to be the case. Then you have to find a way of reducing. For me, you reduce the blast and you make the blast entirely. And I think I might have said this on here before. You make the blast something that actually works with and for the 100s. The two things become symbiotic. At the moment, they work against each other and you're trying to play them both to their fullest extent. It's just not possible. Not if you value playing four-day cricket, not if you value being World Cup winners in the 50 over com. It can't be done. And so as always, something has to give. Now, you talk about championship cricket, 14 games, right? Ideally, ideally, I reckon 12 would probably be enough if we had a different system altogether with fewer teams, etc. But I worry about sort of going any less than 14 simply because we live in a country where the weather isn't particularly good. You could very easily end up, if you started with 10, you could end up with seven completed matches, depending on when they're played. And even then, it doesn't matter. I mean, you could play in the middle of July and August and lose half. You know what I mean? So it's almost an insurance policy to have more games than you would deem necessary in a country where you could rely on the weather a bit more. So I don't think 14 games in and of itself is a massive problem. I think what goes on around it makes it a problem.
Yeah, okay. You've mentioned that's going to be one of the things on the plate of the new managing director a few times, and we don't know much yet about who that could be, but there have been a few reports, and the applications are now closed for it. From what's been reported, we know that Rob Key, Marcus North, Ed Smith and Mark Nicholas have all applied, and it seems like Marcus North might be the front runner. Rob Key and Ed Smith also pretty strong contenders from that. You'll know most of these guys a bit. Who do you think would do a good job? Who do you think's likely to want it the most? And what do you think makes a good managing director as well?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that they all want it, or at least three out of the four I know do. I mean, Keezy is a little bit of a surprise simply because I know him that well, that, and I'd never heard him sort of express a burning desire to do it. But that doesn't mean that it's not so. I think they'd all, in their own ways, bring a real quality and a distant eye to what goes on. I think part of the issue that the English cricket has had is that it's become increasingly myopic. You know, everybody almost comes from within the system, and they're all making decisions based on people they know within the system. And when Ed Smith was removed as chief selector, what was that? India, wasn't it? During the India tour, or just after the India tour, by the last managing director. He was kind of like the last outsider involved in the entire organisation. Everybody else had either been promoted from within or was already within a system which perhaps has become a little bloated. So the thing I like about, you know, Marcus North is perhaps slightly different to that. He's kind of on the inside, but not quite. He brings that sort of, you know, the outsider quality of being from a different country, albeit that he's been doing a terrific job up there at Durham. You know, so I mean, Mark Nicholas, there's absolutely no question his love of the game and his ideas and the way that he thinks about English cricket and its place in the grand scheme of things. I wonder perhaps if he is a little bit too far removed from things, you know, having said it'd be great to have an outside voice, whether or not just his age perhaps and his distance from sort of like the days where he was on the active coalface of cricket might count against him, I don't know. But for the other three, and you know, and Ed Smith, I think as much as he's not going to be the player's favourite, and never was, and that's part of the reason why he ended up out of the job, I think that gives him a real advantage, gave him a real advantage as being somebody that could see things from a different point of view. And if you talk about sort of somebody who has the mental capacity to try and knit together all of the parts around development programs, coaching programs, not to mention when you get to the top and the structure of English cricket and all the rest of it, there's somebody that certainly has the mental capacity to kind of take all that stuff on.
Yeah, okay. And then just finally on the county championship, who's going to win it, do you think?
I don't know who's going to get off to a flyer in April and May. I don't know. I mean, look, from what I saw of Warwickshire as a team last year, they're going to be the team to beat again. Lancs will also be very strong. I don't think there's going to be too much in the way of surprises, really. Essex will be tough again. Nice to see Simon Harmer back playing Test match cricket again after all this time. But you know, I don't think there's going to be a surprise out of that Division One group, with the exception maybe of Yorkshire. If Yorkshire don't end up, and the rights and wrongs of whether they do or don't, particularly given what happened to Durham with their financial problems, if Yorkshire don't end up receiving some sort of points penalty or even and you would have thought they'd have decided upon this by now, or even sort of start off, end up having to swap with somebody in Division Two and start off down there, then they might well have enough righteous indignation to kind of to carry them through into doing something extraordinary at the back of, you know, what's been extraordinary turmoil for that club. So, you know, that maybe they're worth an outside fiver for somebody. But beyond that, I think that the strength lies where it has done before. I mean, Northants, Gloucester, Kent, who are also up there at the top table, will all have their good days, I think. But I'm not sure that any of those are strong enough to challenge. I'm not going to be having a fiver on my old team. Sorry, even though Gareth Batty's taken over and whatever, that they need a good couple of solid seasons of solid cricket before they're up there challenging again. So I think it's up to Warwickshire, Essex, Lancashire, Yorkshire to battle it out at the top, I think.
Well, thanks for joining us as ever. As discussed with Butch, the County Championship starts on Thursday. The format is as it was supposed to be in 2020, with Division 1 containing not everyone plays everyone twice, and Northants, Gloucester and Lancashire all promoted back up based on how they did in 2019.
3 years ago.
Yeah, 3 years ago, yeah. Joe, you've gone Hampshire to win it in the mag. Came within one wicket of clinching it last year. It's just based on, I mean, they've got loads of good players and they've signed some more this season, basically.
So, yeah. That's pretty much it. Yeah, as it goes. It's largely based around the bowling attack, which is, I mean, there are a lot of good bowling attacks around the country. You could argue the best is in Division 2 with Notts as well, certainly in terms of seam. But yeah, Hampshire got Carl Abbott, Mo Abbas, Keith Barker, Brad Will, and then you've got Mason Crane and Liam Dawson. There is plenty to work with there. That was brilliant last year, and they're going to continue to be brilliant. For me, it was that the batting has taken a leap up a bit with Nick Gubbins, who was there for some of last year, but not for all of it. But more crucially, Ben Brown, who's arrived from Sussex and just scores mountains of runs in county cricket every year. James Vince has lacked support, and now he's got it. So I think they look a really well-balanced side. I think
Ben Brown's your new England keeper batsman, right?
Yeah, he's my new
It's amazing
hobby
what
horse.
20 minutes conversation on the phone does.
I was really sold, I have to say. He tackled a lot of the issues that have been talked about well, and it was interesting to see some of the people who were reacting to that piece afterwards, other county cricketers, who obviously felt he was speaking not only for himself, but perhaps for them as well. But yeah, he said himself, I don't know if I'd be any good at test cricket, but no one's ever given me a go. And you can't say much more than that, really.
Well, didn't he say England would be foolish not to consider properly experienced, gnarled players who have been around the block?
Yeah, and the part of the justification for that was, first of all, that we've seen youngsters struggle, but also that players are fitter until they're much older. I mean, you know, Darren Stevens is obviously the extreme example, but players are very, very good at 35, 36 in the way that they would have been just seeing out their career previously. So he thinks the conversation should shift slightly. And I think there's, you know, he's 33, so he's saying that with added motivation, but I think he's right, and England's test team has done nothing to suggest that isn't the case.
Taha, Phil, you're both backing Lancs, I suppose. 6 or 7 weeks of Jimmy, that'll that makes him quite compelling.
Yeah, I heard Phil was backing Lancs, so I thought I'd back them
Phil
too.
Phil backs Lancs every year, didn't he? Certainly last year, possibly the year before that.
I backed Lancashire last year because someone else had backed Essex and I wasn't allowed to back Essix because we needed some variety in the predictions.
This is the level of analysis we have.
And then they did really well, so I decided to back them this year as well.
I mean, they're another side with a very, very good attack.
They replaced Alex Davis pretty well there with Bill Saul. Hassan Ali's a pretty county overseas signing. So you know, with Anderson potentially around for those first few weeks, with Saqib Mahmood.
Tom Bailey as well.
Yeah, Tom Bailey, Hassan Ali. Quite a few decent quicks there. Pretty decent like batting group that doesn't get talked about enough, I think. You know, Jennings is Keane Jennings, Luke Wells, Bahanan obviously played pretty well last year.
Yeah, Bahanan's now become one of the, you know, the key county players, key county number 3-4s in the game, on the edge of the England setup, and from what you hear here and there, he was the standout player on the lion's leg of the Ashes winter. So you have all the components in place. You also have the greatest cricketer who I wouldn't recognise if I walked past him in the street in history, in Dane Vilas, who's captain, keeper, run scorer, all the rest of it. And yet I wouldn't have a clue if I bumped into him in the street. He holds the whole thing together superbly well. I just think they've got a lot of options. Also, you mentioned Phil Salt, who is interested in Red Bull cricket and may well feature at 5 or 6 in that side. But you've also got Liam Livingstone, who will come back at some point and will feature at some point down the line in July and or in September. You've also got possibly Joss Butler, who might want to feature in the odd Red Bull game. So they've got a lot of options. And as you say, they've got a gun seam attack and a brilliant leggy in Mr. Matthew Parkinson, who had the Parkinson klaxon for 25 minutes in. So yeah, look. Yeah, it could be them, or they could get relegated. That's the beauty of the county championship.
This is it, and I've put my name in predictions in the magazine, but it is an absolute mugs game. I mean, yeah, you could genuinely title contenders are also feasibly going down this year. I think you look at that division, Northants look to me like they're going to have a real struggle. But apart from them, Gloucester are the other kind of smaller county that are there.
Good signings, though, Joe. Second club, love Gloucester.
And they won a lot of games last year. They now have to win. Northants, it is tricky, this going back to 2019 thing, because they haven't got any of that record behind them.
So at the risk of just sort of sprawlingly talking randomly about it, Adam Rossington, who was skipper at Northants up until a couple of weeks ago, and received the news from the club that he wasn't going to be captain for this upcoming season. And so, as he diplomatically put it to me this morning at the Essex media press day, I decided to consider what other options might be out there, which is a way of saying I didn't want to play for that club again if I'm not going to be captain. The club released a statement saying this is unfortunate. Rossington has said himself, I'm surprised and saddened to be leaving a club that I've enjoyed playing at for a number of years. However, given the situation around the captaincy and so on and so on, this kind of setback, and he's one of their best players, if not the best player. You know, he's an explosive batter, he's a good keeper, he's a white ball nailed on, but he's a useful Red Bull cricketer. That's the kind of thing where if that happens to a club, especially a club that, as you say, is going to be hanging in there a bit, that happens a week before your first game, then alarm bells, you know, are going there. So you can't bet on much in that top division, but you can probably say that if they survive, that is one hell of an achievement.
Yeah, bizarrely managed situation. I don't know what's gone on there, but to leave it this late, knowing that there was a chance this would happen, and now they're not really in a position to
Yeah, I haven't spoken to anyone from the club, but I spoke to him for 10 minutes this morning, and it was literally his first day in Chelmsford in Essex. They put him up in a hotel overnight, and he's as stunned and baffled by it all as anybody else is, it would seem. And he described it all as very surreal. He said, look, literally this time last week I was gearing up, I'd gone on pre-season with Northants. So look, probably something has been playing out for a while there, and the full story may or may not come out, I don't know, but he certainly did not see this. He wasn't reading the tea leaves on this one.
I suppose two things they do have. I mean, Ricardo Vasconcelos is a very promising young batter and has done very good things. But I'm genuinely interested to see how Ben Sanderson goes in Division One. So it's two up, two down, and none of us have picked Essex to win it. Phil, could they be in that relegation scrap?
Well, I only didn't pick Essex because, you know, I get it in the neck, don't I? Well, if we are going to dwell on Essex, then again, they've recruited well. They've got Critchley in from Derbyshire. Rossington will be useful as a backup keeper bat. They have quality throughout. Dan Lawrence will play 8 games in a row, having come off the back of a half-decent West Indies tour. They've brought in a brilliant overseas option in the Australian quick, whose name I can't pronounce, Stetsdeketi. His record is good. He was top wicket taker for his state last year in Red Bull cricket. He's a white ball cricket star as well. I was speaking to Lawrence about him this morning because he faced him in a Lions game. He says he's quick, tall, strong, but he's got that Aussie coming in hard element to him as well. Essex are really, really thrilled that they've got hold of him, and they had Siddle in place last year. He's a Siddle-esque type bowler. They're strong. They're strong from top to bottom. And the thing with Essex is that they back themselves, they fancy themselves, they believe that they're going to win every game that they play, and not many cricket teams can say that. So they'll be in amongst it, for sure they'll be in amongst it. Simon Harmer, okay, is with South Africa at the moment, but he'll be back within 3 weeks, 2 weeks. He might not play every single game with South Africa being over here in the summer, but that'll be interesting in itself. That'll bring a couple of other options to play. I'm not necessarily saying they're going to win it, because if Harmer only plays, you know, 2/3 of the games, then it might be trickier. Lawrence may well be out of the picture playing for England, so you lose your two real guns there. So they might not win it by any means, but they will be in the mix for sure.
Mm-hmm. I am going to go with Somerset to win it. It's partly heart overhead, but I do think Matt Renshaw, if he is informed, there was some flickers of it, I think, over the Australian season, he could make a big difference.
What's the heart thing, by the way?
I just like them. I mean, I eventually want to see them win a championship in my lifetime.
So you just that would be feel nice. Sorry for them?
No, not sorry exactly. I mean, it's part. I mean, I guess it's heart in that you think, because they have got close so many times, at some point it must happen, which isn't exactly a logical way to think. It's like flipping a coin and getting four tails and thinking the next one must be a heads.
There's also a sense that the fans, and this isn't to say fans don't care elsewhere, but it feels like they particularly care. And Taunton really is like the heart of that Somerset club, and it is a big thing in that. I mean, there's not Premier League football teams around that way, for instance. So it feels like it matters more, and then that makes it more of a story. Also, I think we've all written the story about 3 or 4 times, so it'd be nice if it actually came true.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if you haven't mentioned so far, and it must just be the club here, I think. Sorry, which...
And Kent.
And Kent, yes.
Who I had Kent to go... I mean, that is my home county, but yes. I had Kent to go down with Northants. I know they won Division 3, which, you know, not sure quite what that means. But it's quite a leap to have had a very bad run before they ended up in Division 3 and then find themselves in Div 1. Their batting was an issue last year, and I think will continue to be so. Good. Another side with a good attack, but everyone's got a good attack. It's whether your batters can step up, really.
And future England captain Sam Billings as well. Is running the team, or he's
at the IPL at the moment.
He's in India, isn't he? Yeah. Choosing.
I think Jack Leaning's captain of the Red Bull side for a bit. Right. Drummond's doing the white ball stuff. Until Billings arrives.
Yeah.
But Denley and Bell Drummond both had horrible seasons. I guess that's why Bell Drummond's not captaining the Red Bull side, because he needs to just get his head down and score some runs.
So what one of the few counties we haven't mentioned so far are Surrey. And Yaz spoke to Rory Burns about his slightly strange winter, how he's gearing up for the new season and county pitches and county schedule stuff.
What's your winter been like since you got back from Australia?
It's probably involved quite a bit of family time, to be honest. Took some time away from cricket a little bit. So yeah, it's nice to spend some time with wife and daughter, and just basically reset. And then, been back in pre-season, hitting balls and standing the slips.
How long was your break between getting back from Australia and getting back into the training centre here?
It's probably about 5 weeks in the end. Probably just over a month. It just had a mate stag doing there as well, which was quite nice. So yeah, play some golf, and then just back in amongst it and back with the lads, really.
You've been involved with England for quite a long time, for 3 years, as a very central part of that group. What was it like seeing England play from afar?
Yeah, I probably didn't watch too much of it. I was keeping an eye on the scores and keeping an eye on, obviously, folks who was back in, so it was nice to see him get a go and show what he can do. But yeah, I probably didn't watch too much of it, just supported from afar, really.
There's been loads of chat for the last year or so, particularly after the Ashes and after the West Indies series, about what life is like opening the batting and batting in general in county cricket. One area, one focus has been pitches. Do you think there's anything in the argument that some people are saying that pitches have got worse? What's it, from your perspective, what's life like being an opener now in 2022 compared to what it was in 2014 or something like that?
It's been difficult, I think. Our county cricket promotes, skills-based bowlers that can swing the ball or nibble the ball on green surfaces with a Duke's ball, which obviously suits their own conditions, and probably fulfills the need of counties at times, rather than actually maybe promoting guys forward to the test arena. Like I said, I think facing Stark, Cummins, Hazelwood and Lyon is fractionally different to what you get in the county game. I think the volume of cricket we play in general is probably too much. You're probably asking too much from groundsmen in that time. You're probably asking too much from your players to actually you know, be able to bowl at better speeds and almost promote that on slightly flatter surfaces, and, you know, promote guys that potentially might not do as much of it, but when you come to go to places like Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, hit the pitch harder so they get a bit more out of it.
Interesting that you mentioned Groundsman. Groundsman have come under a bit of fire recently, and I think that's an area that people don't actually understand how it really works. There's a few stats going around that actually April is one of the months in the year where most runs are scored. That kind of does suggest that actually, if there is any problem with the pitches, it's actually because there's quite a lot of cricket being played and there's not much time to turn around a pitch.
Yeah, and like you say, I think they probably have come under fire, and they've probably come a bit under fire unfairly, to be honest. You know, like you say, that's probably when the pitches are their freshest, so you almost get your best scores. But, you know, I think probably as you go through seasons and guys wanting home advantage and those sort of things, like you do when you go most places around the world, everyone wants their own home advantage, so they take advantage of it, probably rather than looking at the bigger picture. And that's probably something that's way above my pay station to try and sort out. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, these things get highlighted and heightened around, you know, times like the Ashes and those sort of things where more scrutiny's come into it. But, you know, it has also in recent years produced cricketers for England. So you can't disagree with that. And, you know, our white ball side's flourishing and the promotion of that. But, yeah, I think the volume of cricket we play in the county game and now obviously with the 100, I think it's probably just marginally unsustainable to actually, you know, get guys taking the park as close to fit as they can be most of the time, particularly from the seamers' point of view. And, yeah, to get guys in their best mindset to go and score runs and almost promote that.
Do you think we've kind of taken for granted how difficult it is being on that grind, both in county cricket but also internationally as well?
Yeah, I think it's something that maybe gets looked past. You know, it's easy to say this bloke scored this amount of runs or taken this many wickets or that many catches. It's probably a lot more difficult to have probably a slight more realistic view of things. You know, he's playing a 2020, he's travelling the next day, he's playing another 2020. I remember that being my month after the New Zealand series, leading into the India series, was playing white ball cricket and day on, day off 2020s and travelling in between. So it's probably the slightly less glamorous side of the game, and probably one that isn't reported on or thought about as much. And I think we can see that with in terms of touring now, and obviously guys trying to make up for that COVID period. There's just so much cricket on. I think in the middle of the summer to look at overseas, I think you've either got the choice of someone from Ireland or Netherlands. I think they're the only two guys not playing any cricket. Which is almost remarkable, really, in itself. So,
is that something that players are talking about more?
I think players are talking more about the amount of cricket that's being played, and obviously, you know, where the money's made in cricket is towards the 2020 side of the game and the white ball side of the game. And it also doesn't take as long, and it takes people away from their families, less time, and those sort of things. So, I think it's something that, you know, cricket as a game needs to be, you know, cautious of, really, and be careful of to not overdo it.
On Surrey going into the season, how do you feel you guys are prepped for this season compared to previous seasons, compared to 2018, for example, when you won it?
Yeah, I think the boys, you know, I think we've got a young squad now, a much younger squad than we have done. We obviously lost a couple of senior players, and Jade and Ricky and those sort of things. And I was the oldest on deck in pre-season, which was quite remarkable, seeing as I still consider myself about 25, but there you go. But yeah, I think we're in a good place. I think, you know, the work the guys are putting over the winter, you know, batting and bowling in particular, but also with their fitness and those sort of things, I think we're in a good place to try and hit the ground running.
Burns is an interesting one, isn't he, Phil? Because he's, you know, been in and out of the England side a bit. He's got sort of a middling record, although it compares well to the other players they've tried at the same time. It feels make or break, but it also feels like maybe he is the best opener in the country still, possibly. I mean,
let's jump back on the carousel and keep going round and round and round. I've got a soft spot for Rory Burns as a player. I think he looked like a passably good test match opener a year or so ago. He was on fire coming into last summer, made a good 100 against New Zealand. I still think on what I've seen of the four or five openers that have been looked at over the last couple of years, I still think he's probably got the most to offer at this point. And there was some interesting footage that came through. Now, I haven't heard the specifics of that interview, but I did speak to him myself last week, and I asked him about his technique, and he had spent the time that he would have otherwise been in West Indies simplifying certain elements of it. And he said quite openly, you know, there's obviously a lot of things going on with my technique, and rhythm and flow is very key to it, and it has to work in sync for me to feel comfortable. And he has sought to reduce some of the more idiosyncratic elements of it. So the head tilt, the iconic head tilt to mid-wicket, is gone. And the kind of the second waggle is my technical term. When he takes the bat up, and you can picture it in your mind, and then there's a kind of a second movement. And sometimes, if that movement is slightly off kilter, then he doesn't get into the ball quite as smoothly as he would like. Well, he's simplified that as well. So now what you have is actually a very convincing looking setup for a left-hander who looks straight down the track, picks his bat up behind him, and then just eases into the shot. It looks good. It looks sensible. It looks like it makes sense. And look, it might not work out for him, but this is a bloke with a storied county career anyway. And so I could well see him having a good run, actually, over the next couple of months. And then he becomes squarely back in that conversation for England. Yeah, this is just a bloke who's just trying to make his way through again, get to a point where he's comfortable with it, with his game. And I feel, my instinct is that he'll go really, really well. And then I'd be surprised, to be honest, if he's not, if he doesn't feature again in that England Test side by the end of the year, at least.
Yeah, and Surrey, do we see them as just firmly mid-table? Do we see them anything more or even less than that? Or is that kind of where they've been for the past bit of time, it kind of feels like?
Well, if they get a lot of Burns and potentially Pope, if Pope doesn't necessarily find himself back in that 11, then you kind of have to say that they're in with a shout, because those guys are just going to, you know what they're going to get in the County Championship. You might not know what you're going to get when they play for England.
20 wickets was a problem again here last year.
Struggling to get results at your home ground is really tough to win the championship if you don't do that. That's got to be a bread and butter, and they just don't hoover up those home wins. And got Kemo Roach for the first bit of the season. I mean, you know, that should help. Dan Worrell from Gloucestershire, the Aussie, should help. But that batting lineup, if they've got everyone available, you could argue it's the best batting lineup in the country. With Amla coming back as well, Will Jacks, Jamie Smith. There's a lot of options there.
Sam Curran will be around.
Sam Curran playing, just as a batter to start the season, isn't he, before he gets fit. And then,
but he said he is bowling, so it shouldn't be massively long until he's able to offer both.
And two spinners in Verdi and Morales. I mean, they've got... Look, I wouldn't be surprised if we're sitting here in September and they've won the title, but I just think there are sides that have got a slightly better kind of balanced side.
Yeah, and we haven't mentioned Yorkshire, at least we haven't mentioned Yorkshire, but Butcher's tipped them to possibly go close to winning it. I guess it's tough to discuss them from a cricketing point of view while there is still this shadow kind of hanging over them. There was an extraordinary general meeting in the past week where they passed a number of key sort of resolutions which has allowed them to perhaps, sort of theoretically host international cricket again this summer. There's still a bit more to be checked off on that. There is more to go with the ECB sort of their disciplinary process as well. So we don't even know yet about possible points deductions. Gary Balance is sitting out the start of the season as well as he sort of gets focused, although he will remain at the club, is the latest news. So it's just so hard to know whether as a side, when we don't really know whether as a club.
Got a lot of talent, got a lot of good players, and obviously Otis Gibson he's a top man, immensely popular figure. If they can get a squad together, playing together, then they've got the talent to push things for sure. You know, Harry Brook he had a really good year in red ball cricket, let alone white ball cricket last year. In very, very, very interesting player. Intriguing, really. But on the Lord Patel thing, I'm not qualified to talk with any real authority on it, but when you think about the people that they've managed to get together and what was at stake if that EGM had gone the other way, and we've talked about the machinations at play inside the club. When I saw the news that Patel had been backed not unanimously, but overwhelmingly backed. I couldn't help thinking that that is really, really good news for the future of the club. And hopefully him and others can begin to drag that great institution back to where it ultimately needs to be.
I have found it quite hard to work out Division 2, apart from Notts looking very, very strong. I kind of think Durham will go up with the rest, but Joe, you picked Middlesex to go up with Notts in the mag. What do you like about them?
That was definitely the Shaheen effect. I thought that, I can't remember how long he's around for, but I thought he might win them enough games to get ahead enough of the game that they will get up. I think Durham are a really good shout as well. I think Glamorgan as well. I think Glamorgan with Labuschagne, Northeast, Nessa's over as well. James Harris back from Middlesex. I was actually surprised looking through the Division 2 sides. I think there are more stronger teams than I would have given Division 2 credit for, actually. I think that'll be quite a tight race, but it's hard to see anyone stopping Notts as Division 2 winners. I mean, that attack is good enough for a few test sides around the world.
We were picking out certain fixtures that could be good to watch for the magazine. And the Sussex Middlesex fixture will be a good one, because they've got Mohamed Rizwan. Sussex have got Mohamed Rizwan against Shaheen Afridi. You know, that would be a classic. And so you're right. There is
the quality of the county championship. That's Division 2.
There is more quality in Div 2 than people will give credit for, I think.
Yeah, there'll definitely be a clip of them hugging, which just makes Middlesex or Sussex social media manager's day or week. There's nothing you mentioned in that section of the mag was just the amount of Pakistan players that are over. We're going to get to Nazim Shah in a bit, but it's just, I guess it's the IPL effect really, which is they're not able to play in the IPL, so yeah. This is where they can get some cash.
The other interesting one, I mean, I'm not saying they're going to win Div 2, but Derbyshire have got like a, you know, world-class coach in Mickey Arthur, and obviously he's used his Pakistan connection of having coached them to reel in Shah Massoud, who's kind of a understated opener who's, you know, hit test hundreds.
He's in brilliant form as well in Pakistan domestic cricket.
Yeah, hit great test 100 against England a couple of years ago. Yeah, and just quite interesting to see, you know, how a guy who's coached, Australia, South Africa, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, how he kind of changes a club, which kind of was looking like everything was kind of doom and gloom about Derbyshire at the end of last year. They lost Critchley, who was their best player.
They brought in Lakmal as well.
Yeah.
On a 2-year contract. And he's given up international cricket. So that's a great county signing, really. I mean, you'd think he'd suit these conditions pretty well. It's an interesting test. How much difference can a coach make? Because, you know, they've got Massoud and Lakmal are two good signings, but that's a Derbyshire side that lacks quality in lots of areas. Can Arthur drag them up and make them Division 2 promotion contenders? It'll be fascinating to see. And it's great that Mickey Arthur wants to come and coach Derbyshire in Division 2 of the county county championship. I mean,
the Peak District is beautiful, though.
It is.
You know, and there's got to be an element of that. You know, he's done the rounds all over the world. This is a beautiful place to come and coach for a couple of years. Yeah, we wish him well, actually.
It is great, I guess, that Derbyshire have that pull. I do wonder what it says about the economics of the world game that you have him and Otis Gibson, who's an international standard coach, both pulled into county cricket rather than at test sides, but great, great for Derbyshire. I've mentioned the mag a lot there, and the county preview section, I have to say, is really excellent this year. Besides team-by-team previews done by Joe, there's bigger feature on Notts and Derbyshire, and Joe's also done a piece on Durham's history as a first-class county, with this marking their 30th year, and there's lots else beside. We got a special offer, but should we just talk a bit more about the mag and how great it is?
Talk all day about the mag. You just ask the questions and we'll...
what else is great about the mag?
It came out quite a while ago, basically, because I was ill for a bit. Everyone forgot to talk about the magazine, so so now we're back on
it. We were banished from even being on the show. I mean, they pissed off to Barbados for 2 weeks, didn't they? What do you do?
There's a lovely tribute section to Shane Warne. This is where the Kirsten one is in this one as well, isn't it? Eventually made it in there. I've got my Golden Summers in there, so make sure you ignore that bit.
No, that's the final ever My Golden Summer for regular readers of the magazine.
It was so bad.
A long-running series, and Ben has rounded off. No, we like that one.
It's genuinely good, Ben.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's in the top half.
Okay, good.
Strong phrase there.
I'll ask you what you really think after the show. Listeners can try Wisden Cricket Monthly for just £9.99. To get your first three print issues for £9.99 and save 39% on the cover price, go to wizandsubs.com and enter offer code POD22. To get twice as many issues, but none of the paper, go to bit.ly/WCWPod6. This will all be in the description of wherever you're listening to or watching this. If you go there, you'll save a whopping 58% on the single issue price and be all set for the next 6 months. Back to our county preview. We've all picked out a couple of players to watch in the county championship this season. Taha, do you want to start us with yours?
Well, I sort of mentioned Phil Salt earlier, you know, joining from Sussex. Didn't actually play any first-class cricket last summer, but I remember a couple of years ago when the Bob Willis Trophy was happening, that he was kind of, he's quite interesting because he was opening the batting and he, you know, hits at a decent rate. He's not really kind of, I think he strikes at 70 in first-class cricket. So there's something exciting about that. Whether he opens for Lancashire, we don't know. But seeing him play for England now, obviously that's T20 cricket, completely different beast. But he's a fun player to watch because he just kind of, I think even across forms, he's just going to go and give it a whack. The other one is Nassim Shah at Gloucester. He kind of popped up yesterday doing an interview. Said he'd gone from 38 degrees to -1. But yeah, he's 19 years old, already been around for a while. Hugely exciting, you know, bowls. It's not that he just bowls fast, it's that he has the ability to maintain that pace throughout a whole day's play. The interesting thing will be to see him in county cricket, where you're playing week in, week out, and whether Gloucester try and manage that or whether they just let him go all out.
It will be fascinating. And yeah, if it works, then it opens up that option to other players. If it looks like a drudge and they don't manage him, I think they will, by the way. I can't imagine that he'll be playing every single game. And for years, he'll certainly be grazing in a long leg for large parts of it. You can't over bowl a player like that. But if it does work, then, you know, young West Indian quicks, young Pakistani quicks, obviously, young Sri Lankan quicks. I mean, how many good young Sri Lankan quicks are there? You can look at that and you can pick up a very, very good wage. But there is a bit of a stigma attached to it, isn't there? You know, who wants to bowl quick in England anymore?
When you think of a county side signing an overseas quick, you think of you know, from a Pakistani perspective, you think of Mohammed Abbas, right? Who's like very much an English style seamer, or you think of an Australian like Peter Siddle, who's played for countless counties. You don't really think of the out and out 90 mph quick, which is why this is sort of particularly exciting, and I'm sure it'll be a great learning experience for him.
It'll be fascinating to see how fast he thinks he should bowl as well, because Jofra Archer always talked about there were so many days in county cricket where he decided, nah, it's not worth bowling fast on this pitch. I'm going to just bowl within myself. And he had the skills to do that and still be a hugely threatening bowler. Is Nassim Shah, who looks like he just wants to bowl fast every day, he bowls. Is county cricket going to not break him? I mean, hopefully it doesn't break him injury-wise, but just, is it going to change that resolve? Is he going to think, well, you know, that's not actually the best way to take wickets? If that is the case, you know, this is a hugely exciting signing, but if you see him come here and be something different, then that would be quite depressing. So hopefully you see him at his best.
If he returns and he's 78 miles an hour hitting the top of off, nipping it both ways, is it? That'll tell us quite a lot, yeah. Joe, do you want to give us your players to watch?
So I had a fast bowler in Bryden Cass at Durham, who I think he got a knee injury over the winter, which meant he left the Lions and couldn't go to the Big Bash. I interviewed Scott Borthwick a couple of weeks ago, who's his skipper at Durham, and said he might miss the first couple of games, but he's getting there. He's one of those players, you compare him to other seamers in county cricket and his average doesn't stand out. I think he averages 28 or 29, and you know, as a county seamer, you should really be averaging 22, 23, but Cass looks like one of those bowlers who you don't want to judge him too much on his county record in terms of what he could do at Test cricket. He's quick. Borthwick said he's generally one of the quickest you'll face in county cricket. He's strong, apart from the fact he keeps getting injured, and he can hold a bat. He's a bowling all-rounder, could bat at nine, give it a whack. We saw him sort of fill the Liam Plunkett role in that odd ODI series where he was part of the emergency squad. I think there's potential there. It's probably one-day cricket first, but I think we might see him in and around the Test setup in the next 18 months or so as well. And suddenly all our fast bowlers are injured as well. So, you know, if you can bowl fast and you're fit, then you've got quite a good chance of getting picked.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good shout on your part there. I think I saw him bowl last year with a bit of an injury at Essex, but he was brilliant, indomitable. Reminds me a bit of Simon Jones, you know, slightly taller maybe than Jones and not quite as rapid, but similar kind of athlete, fast bowler. And I know that England are really keen on him.
And then I was sort of looking at what England needed and who might be in the mix. And, you know, opening batsman, we're going to keep going around to it. Burns, I agree with Phil. I think Burns will be right in the mix. But then there are two lefties, and I've gone with Rob Yates at Warwickshire. Tom Haynes was the other one at Sussex. I was thinking about, I think Haynes is batting in Division 2. Big difference. He's also got to be captain at Sussex, which wasn't the plan, but Travis Head pulled out. I think that's quite a big ask to suddenly see him playing Test cricket soon. But Rob Yates scored 5 Red Bull hundreds last year, 4 in the Championship, 1 in the Bob Willis Trophy on the telly at Lords, which, you know, helps. And I just think he's interesting. He plays in lots of different ways depending on the situation. I think that's one thing we've already talked about on this show that a lot of English young batters have failed to do. He scored a quick century against Somerset, which set up their win, which won them the title. He scored a fourth innings 100 against Essex early doors, seeing off Simon Harmer. So those kind of things, I think, are what England selectors, when we actually know who they'll be, will think. You know, he's got something about him. And Paul Farbrace, it's a little bit hard to tell with Farbrace because every player you talk to about with Farbrace, he said he's going to play for England and is fantastic. But I think some of the things he said about Yates and in terms of his mental makeup and how he thinks he'll adapt to Test cricket, in that sense, technique obviously remains to be seen, but he thinks he can see him being comfortable as a Test cricketer. So he's another one that I'll be keeping a close eye on this season. And yeah, I think maybe Test cricket this summer is a push, but I think maybe a winter tour, it might well be on the cards.
Yeah, I've gone for Sam Robson, who obviously we know a bit about. Has played some Test cricket, but it's just going to be because he was being so talked about in the winter, just because he was in Australia, and because you know, people looked back at that record when he first played Test cricket, was like, that doesn't look so bad now. And he also always scores loads of runs
early on.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah, 1,000 runs last year, I think, wasn't he one of the few?
Yeah. So I think it'll be basically that there is obviously loads of spots open. And he is now one of those ones who just finds himself back in the conversation almost by default, but he does have a chance. The other one is Leicestershire's Callum Parkinson, because I think he's one who, so Joe, we've talked about him on the podcast before, but he just as a spinner in county cricket, he has an actually quite impressive record, and might not take too long for a guy like that, who is also just interesting from a county point of view, of having got a senior role in that side at a reasonably young age, seeing if he does put together a run of form, that can become a conversation reasonably quickly. Not saying that will happen, but that's why I'll be keeping an eye on him.
He will bowl loads of overs.
Yes,
and there are not many spinners around the country who can say that for sure. He's vice captain at Leicestershire. He's got a senior role. He will just take wickets by virtue of bowling lots of overs, so he's going to be in and around the conversation. And I think he's really good. Interesting to see at Leicestershire as well. There's Rian Ahmed, the young leggy who was with England Live teams.
Yeah.
Massive googly. Spoke to Jigar Naik, who's their head of talent pathway now. Who's really, really excited about him. He's still only 17 or 18. I think he might be 17. So, you know, he is young. But that he's certainly one of those kind of potential X-factor cricketers who I think is going to be really exciting to follow in the next couple of years.
Mm, yes. Phil, who from Essex are you following?
Matt Critchley.
Didn't even rise to the dig there.
Can't be bothered anymore. I was just wondering if you're interested in watching any Division 1 players, but clearly you pitched your tent in Div 2. Yeah. That's fine.
I'm a purist.
Sure. Matt Critchley, for obvious reasons. You know, I think he was second in the MVP last year. Made 1,000 runs, took a fair few wickets in a struggling Derbyshire side. He bowls leg breaks. He's tall. He's about 6'3". He's with the ball, he said he's, you know, he didn't actually say this to me, but he gave the impression that he trusts himself more in white ball cricket than red ball cricket at the moment with the ball. But he will be Harmer's understudy with the ball. Essex like having two spinners historically. That's the way that they're going to go again here. He says he's a genuine all-rounder in both formats. So He'll be batting in the top six in the Red Bull stuff, and he'll be bowling his fair number of overs as well in what's quite a varied attack now. So it'll be interesting to see how he goes. And the other one's Jamie Smith here, right, who at the Oval, who has been opening in the pre-season games, and Alex Stewart hasn't confirmed yet if he'll be opening, but it's looking like it's a distinct possibility. If he doesn't open, then he'll certainly be in that first 11, I think. They really, really like him here. If he does open the batting, then I think that's a fascinating move for them. Quite a daring one as well. He's 21 years old. He was their player of the year last year. He's made 400s in 20-odd games. He averages a tick under 40 in Red Bull cricket. He finished last year with 140-odd here, albeit on a shirt front. And a very good 100 the week before against North Ants when Surrey were something like 10 for 3 and he made 100 from number 5. As I say, they see him as a star. A couple of people said to me off record that he'll be an England opener somewhere down the line. He's obviously just getting going. And we know how difficult it is for talented young openers to crack it in England. I mean, one name we didn't mention was Tom Lamonby, right? Remember him? You know, 300s in 5 or 6 games in 2020 for Somerset. Couldn't lay a bat on it last year. And it might go one or two ways again with who's clearly a very talented player. Back to Smith. They really like him here. He likes himself, and I say that respectfully. I interviewed him, and you can't fake confidence, but he's got it, and he knows what he can offer. So yeah, I'm going to watch him. I think it'll be tough for him initially if he does open. I think it'll be tough for him initially. But from what I've heard and from what you've seen, they see him as an opening batsman. And I asked him that, and he said obviously, as they all do, I'll bat anywhere. But he said I'd love to open. He said he's been working on opening. He's been working on his Red Bull defensive technique all winter, with a view to becoming, you know, a top order player in a club that still has more power and sway than any other in the land. So it'll be interesting to see how he goes.
Yeah. Anyway, there's lots of county championship over the next 7 weeks, as we said. So we'll come back to it. If you want to live stream your matches this season, then look no further than Frogbox and make your fixtures a professional broadcast. Frogbox is the all-in-one streaming kit that makes broadcasting live cricket accessible for clubs, schools and associations in the UK. Designed for recreational cricket, the Frogbox solution is innovative, lightweight and low-cost product designed for volunteer-operated clubs. Integrated with the Play Cricket Scorer app, all you need to do on match day is set up the portable video capture kit and live score the match on the app. Their automation technology will take care of the rest.
This is meant to be really good, by the way. I've heard a few people mention it in club cricket. It's meant to be great. So yeah, get on it.
Yeah, and you can stream to YouTube with high-quality graphics, generate highlights for your greatest moments and connect with your community like never before.
I thought you'd finished the advert.
No,
sorry.
I know. I was only about halfway through. Frogbox professionally showcases cricket at any level while offering new revenue opportunities for amateur cricket clubs. The automated graphics package has multiple displays and advertising opportunities available, engaging the end user and delivering high-quality visibility for your corporate partners. Capture those special moments with automated highlight generation and join the streaming revolution with Frogbox. Visit their website at www.frogbox.live for further information and start re-managing the matchday experience. As Phil says, it's really good.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that was already in there, which was weird. So on to some international cricket. Pakistan beat Australia 2-1 in an ODI series, come from 1-0 down. There were 200s and a half century each from Babar Azam and Imam Haq. Andrew Morris says, no specific question, but can you please do a few minutes on Babar Azam? And we normally do, I think. It's not new to say that Babar is good, but it does feel like he's gone to another level over the last month or so, Taha.
I mean, the thing is, you know, I think he's been cited for a while that he's kind of probably, if not the best, one of the best all format batters in the world. But you could still look at T20s and say, oh, he doesn't score quick enough, or you could look at Test cricket and say that he doesn't convert enough. But when it comes to 50 over cricket, there's no counter argument, really. He's kind of one of the best there is, and probably after Kohli right now. I mean, he's averaging more than Kohli right now, isn't he? And now has, what, 1600s? I think 5 is captain in 12 matches.
What's he like? Because I get no read on him at all as a bloke. Obviously, I get a lot of reads on him as a batsman.
I think he's still quite hard to kind of understand, really. I think you kind of still... He's not like... It doesn't seem like he's...
He seems quite self-contained, right?
Yeah, but there's also times when you watch him captain and he's not good at sort of masking it. He's not that... He's completely the opposite of like a Dhoni who kind of you could never read. Whereas Barber, you can... When he's frustrated, he'll kind of like... You can see him.
He throws strops, doesn't
he? Yeah, he throws... And there's a stroppiness to it. But I also... In a way, don't mind that because you're kind of... He kind of seems like he's comfortable in letting his team know how he feels, right? But they're still not... It's still hard to understand his captaincy. I think he's quite a defensive captain from what I've seen in Test cricket, at the very least. I mean, the one thing is that it's clear to see now that he still has what Kohli and Williamson had in those early years and still kind of do. What Smith had is that the batting is still very much there. I think there might have been a concern with Test cricket whether he was kind of losing it, but then we saw that incredible innings in Karachi, and it's very clear that he can do the captaincy bit and still do what he does, which is look incredible and score big runs. In ODI cricket, there's something else about him in that he has the tempo. In the first ODI, I think he kind of 57 off 70 something when they were chasing over 300, and it kind of looked like he didn't get the tempo right. But then in the second one, he hit 100 and something off 80 something balls. Yeah. So already he has a claim to being maybe Pakistan's greatest in that format. I think Saidan was the only batter who's made more hundreds than him, and Barber's only played like 80 something matches, which is kind of ridiculous.
For the moment, for averages with those with 2,000 runs or more, it's Babar first, Kohli second, and Imam Al-Haq third. He's averaging like 54 in ODI cricket at the moment. So they've got a lot that's exciting. And it's obviously great watching Shaheen as well. It's crazy that this first over thing he's got is just like this aura where you are genuinely surprised if he doesn't take a wicket, which he played two games and did it twice. And it's not even particularly good ball sometimes. Like he got two wickets with two full tosses, Finch and then Head, I think. But they just like they're just expecting something unplayable. So something that's like a full toss then becomes surprising and then gets them out. It's like a force of nature, isn't it?
It's just always an event. Yeah. And I think it's not just Shaheen who recognises that. I think it's the rest of the team in that the way they react after balls that kind of like a ball kind of go past the edge and it's definitely not a nick. It's nowhere near a nick. But the way they all kind of react to it is just... It's just everything's just so dramatic. Everything is just so heightened because it's the Shaheen over.
On the Australia side and the ODIs, I don't think they'll be too worried about the series going down because it's partially a second string team. But Aaron Finch's form has caused a few questions in the Australian media. So he's now gone 15 innings across T20s and ODIs without a half century. And he's talked about questioning himself and knowing his form isn't up to scratch. And he is 35. So that'll be one to keep an eye on ahead of the next T20 World Cup. South Africa begun their series against Bangladesh. They won the first test, which was as expected, but it played out in an odd sort of way, with South Africa's spinners doing the bulk of the damage, including four wickets on the second evening for Simon Harmer, playing his first test since 2015, which is nice to see, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, he took 7 for in the game. It's great to see him getting that platform that he's been itching to be back on for quite a while. Maharaj as well, who might kind of have his... be looking over his shoulder. He took 7 for 30 or 7 for 31, I think it was, in that second innings. Bangladesh are complaining officially to the ICC.
Yeah.
For umpiring
a weird game
shenanigans,
for
misdemeanours.
So they gave a good account of themselves 4.5 days. Mamadou Hassan Joy, who was part of that U19 World Cup winning team and a half century in that win in New Zealand, he made a brilliant 100. They sort of kept the first innings lead down. They've then bowled South Africa out for 200, so chasing 280 to win. They were quite frustrated on the final evening by some umpiring decisions, with the team manager saying they could have been chasing 180 rather than 270 if it weren't for the umpires, and have since lodged an official complaint with the ICC over some of the decisions. It's not as if there was one absolute howler or like a sort of flashpoint incident. It was just accumulation of decisions which were overturned on DRS and the feeling that overall that meant that, you know, the umpires' call decisions weren't going their way and that sort of thing. But they were then bowled out 53 on the final morning, so it wouldn't have made too much difference if they were chasing 180 rather than 270, but still worth keeping an eye on how that...
I mean, I haven't seen these decisions. I don't know how grievous they are, but it'd be a shame if one of the consequences of a kind of return to neutral umpires, as, you know, one of the consequences of COVID and so on, results in less trust between teams. That would be an unfortunate, unintended consequence of it, but...
I suppose that's the thing, is you're always going to have that.
Yeah.
But yeah. And we'll have much more in the IPL next week, but Joss Butler has scored a century and Liam Livingstone is still pretty good with bat and with ball. As it stands, CSK and Mumbai Indians are both struggling, so it's all changed there, but it's also very early days in the competition. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed, please do leave us a nice, maybe even a 5-star review on the app of your choice.
Podcast Network.